This is Betty Trunell speaking for the Decatur Public Library. Our guest today is Mr. Bob Strongman. Well, Mr. Strongman, I understand that you've lived in Decatur, as you pointed out, not all your life yet, but so far. You were born here. What was Decatur like when you were a boy?
Well, I was born over on North Union Street, 1125 North Union, and I can remember it not all that well. However, my mother reminds me it was an old iron bed in the northwest corner of the bedroom because everybody didn't go to the hospital to have youngsters in those days. And I was born July the 12th, 1914. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of fond memories about Decatur and when I was a youngster, and it seemed to me the things that I can remember vividly was the fact that it seemed our winters were more severe. I remember as a youngster my dad pulling me on a sled and the ground was all snow covered, and that the old Pugh school grounds at the corner of that would have been Monroe and Leafin Avenue, between Grand and Leafin, west of Monroe Street, they had a huge playground, and they put some forms around it, and every winter the firemen would come out and flood the field and you could all go ice skating. Mm. And my dad would put his ice skates on, pull me clear across to across the several blocks that it took to get there, and he would skate and pull me along on his sled. That's one of the things I can remember about winters in Decatur. It always seemed to me like they were more severe until, what was it, two or three years ago when we had this one that inundated us?
I don't think we'd want any more that's severe than those that we had recently. Of course, another reason that might have made it seem more severe was that we weren't used to the conveniences, the heat and the insulation in homes and so on. Or do you feel that it really was more severe?
I think that we probably didn't have the snow removal equipment, and I can remember vividly some fella coming down who drove a horse down the sidewalk with a funny little V-shaped plow on behind it. He kind of sat there and by this little one-horse chaise, shall we call it, a plow, and scooped. That's how they cleaned off the sidewalks in the neighborhood. And this was a Mr. Hoddy, if I remember correctly, and he lived over on the corner of Packard and Edward Street. Mm-hmm. He was the same Mr. Hoddy that used to drive his cows from down around Van Dyke and Packard Street up the hill every night to milk them and back the next morning to put them in pasture. And that's when Van Dyke and Packard and that area out there was cornfield and pasture land.
Right, wow.
And this is how I remember getting the snow off the streets. So perhaps maybe things weren't as severe as we all thought, but it seemed like we had more snowfall.
You remember it.
Yeah, I remember that vividly.
What about summer? Did you chase the ice wagon?
Always chased the ice wagon, came down the street with the fella, and you had the card you put in your window, and you put it in with the various numbers marked on the corner telling you what size block of ice that you wanted. And he would very dutifully deliver this in the back door and put it on top of one of those old oaken ice chests that had the things underneath and the water pan beneath, which dutifully you emptied or you had to mop up the kitchen floor. And we all chased the ice wagon to get the chips that he knocked off when he chipped up these huge 300-pound blocks that he had.
How about games that kids played then?
Oh, we played street hockey a lot. Mm-hmm. Everybody had a tin can and a broomstick, and if you were lucky, well, you went out in the country where your grandfather lived and you cut down a piece of hedge that was curved like a hockey stick, and you were kind of one of the pros in the neighborhood if you had one of those to knock the tin can around.
Those were just boys who played that.
Certainly. The girls sit on the sideline and watched her, or didn't even bother to come out and pay any attention to those ornery boys who were knocking this tin can up and down the street.
Or play jacks or dolls or something.
Sure.
Of course, play was a lot of fun, but you did have to go to school eventually.
Yes, I went to school at Lincoln School in the grade school, which still stands today. It's like they say, they don't make them like they used to. And this is still a beautiful, solid old building over in the corner of Marietta and Church Street. And one of my earliest remembrances is going over there when my brother went to what was called Marietta School. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of hazy. It was a big old red brick school, and I can remember going inside with my mother and my oldest brother, and looking around. Then a few years later, that one was torn down, mm-hmm. and Lincoln School was built. And I went to Lincoln School, and then when I got to be about 12 years old, and in the fourth grade, and we had teachers like Miss Honeyfinger, who was my first fourth grade teacher. We had Miss Klickner, and I can't remember her name. She was principal of the Lincoln School mm-hmm. at that time. And these are a few names. And Miss McAvoy was my first grade teacher. Mm-hmm. We didn't have kindergarten, mm-hmm. and nobody went to kindergarten. You were pretty much self-taught, mm-hmm. Self-taught, home-taught, mm-hmm. however you want to describe this. My mother taught you to mm-hmm. Read or try the ABCs mm-hmm. or what little things they tried to. But from Lincoln School, and we moved out into the country, out what's Rock Springs Road and the St. Louis Bridge Road, which was the old Enterprise School District. Mm-hmm.
You went to a country school there?
Yes.
A one-room school?
A one-room school. And then later on, after I left, they decided they needed some more room, and they made a two-room school uh-huh. out of it. But they had grades, when I was there, 1 through 9, and you had grades like 1 year you had 1, 3, 5, 7, and 9, the next year you had 2, 4, 6, and 8, and the classes all had the recitation benches uh-huh. up in front. And then you went to Roosevelt Junior High School to take your junior high school year.
Going back to the one-room school, some people might wonder how you could manage. Did some children study while others were reciting? Or?
Oh, yes, very much so, very much so. There were the recitation. They had mm-hmm. three huge recitation benches up in front, the lids folded up or whatever you call them. And each class went up and did their mm-hmm. homework recitation. Everybody else did their studying. Didn't have much homework. You didn't have mm-hmm. much homework to take home.
You had a longer day.
Well, we went to school at 8 in the morning, got home at 4 in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. Yes, we did have a longer
and
day.
And stayed over the noon hour?
Yes, ma'am.
Took your lunch.
Everybody took their lunch, and mm-hmm. I can vividly remember sitting on that wooden fence down there trading bean sandwiches to somebody that had bologna.
And maybe like a lot of children, your favorite time was recess.
Oh, yes. Recess was much fun. Played all kinds of funny games like bounce ball and things. And I can mm-hmm. remember the day that the teacher named Mr. Jeffries was running like mad. We had an old platform that was first base. You had two bases, a tree in this platform. And if you hit the ball, you went over to first base and then ran for second base and had to come back.
The teacher played with you?
Oh, yes, the mm-hmm. teacher played with us. And he was a rather energetic fellow. But we had a fellow who was still around town, Ernest Kaczynski. And he shows up in one of our Macon County historical books. There's mm-hmm. a picture of Ernest and myself looking at the tree that Mr. Jeffrey mm-hmm. ran to. He was running like mad, trying not to get hit. We call it dodgeball mm-hmm. or some similar name. And he was turning around looking to see if Kaczynski, who had a powerful arm, could hit him with this rubber ball, and ran right smack in the tree and knocked him out, and everybody went home and had a half day off.
The hard way.
The hard way.
Well, you had your grade school experience, and then you went to high school.
Roosevelt Junior High School, and we had E.J. Muffley was, I think at that time, the assistant principal, and a fellow named Carmichael was, and I can't remember Mr. Carmichael's first name. He was the principal, and E.J. Muffley was the assistant principal there. And incidentally, that was the ninth grade, and Coach Gay Kittner was the football coach. Mm-hmm. And we had junior high school football at that time.
Did you play?
No, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Did not play. I had to walk 3 miles mm-hmm. home, so I didn't have time.
You had your exercise
we
that
We got
way.
My exercise by walking from Roosevelt School to the corner of Rock Springs Road.
No bus.
No buses. Mm-hmm. No buses. Went to school with my father in the morning, and he worked at the old Lion Lumber Company over on the corner of Broadway and Cerro Gordo mm-hmm. Street. And then I would walk home each evening. Year-round, rain, snow,
whatever. How did your father get to town?
We had a Model T touring car. Model T touring car.
Now, that brings up a whole new episode of the Model T.
Well, matter of fact, we got real prosperous finally and got two cars. We had a Model T pickup truck. And my father was a very good mechanic on Model Ts. And I can remember when the automobile started getting a little more complicated, he finally decided that he wasn't quite the mechanic mm-hmm. that he wanted to be. And years back, in times when I was younger, he was a mechanic at various garages mm-hmm. around town, the old Cadillac garage, and worked for mm-hmm. a Mr. Freedy and somebody else in the Ford garage that my dad worked for off and on,
mm-hmm.
along with all various grocery stores and things that he worked at in those times. People didn't pursue trades at, we call us the blue collar class mm-hmm. level at that time. He worked at Buckmaster's Grocery Store for a long time, which was the corner of Grand Avenue and Edward Street, where Lorton's Drugstore is now, same building.
Mm-hmm.
He also was over, worked with them then later on, over on the corner of King and Monroe Street. That was between jobs, mm-hmm. after jobs, or somewhere mm-hmm. along in there. I think the thing I remember, along with schooling, was all these little neighborhood grocery stores.
Oh, yes. Maybe you could tell us about them.
Oh, they were just everywhere. The one that now houses... there's a barber shop in it at the corner of Marietta and Edward Street, mm-hmm. North Edward Street, which that would put it in the end of the 900 block on the southwest corner, was Piggly Wiggly. Mm-hmm. And not too many people in town remember Piggly Wiggly's.
That was about the first of the chain stores, wasn't
pretty
it?
Much so. Pretty much so.
The first of self-help.
Yes, you went through a turnstile.
And I believe that's where the term Piggly Wiggly, you had to go through the turnstile.
They had some funny comment about food for the world or something mm-hmm. like this, and the Piggly Wiggly, which later became mm-hmm. Fisher Grocery mm-hmm. Stores, which later became Eisner. Mm-hmm.
But these were far from supermarkets, not big stores.
No, most of them were not big stores. I can think of several that were around mm-hmm. town. There was one mm-hmm. in the 1000 block North Water Street, which was one of the larger ones. There was one on North Oakland Avenue where the... entertainment type place, a Lock, Stock, and Barrel.
Oh, yes.
A Lock, Stock, and Barrel was one time a Piggly Wiggly.
But you were saying that there were small corner stores, kind of convenience.
Many small corner stores. I can remember Mr. Draper, who we'd go down and lean on the counter mm-hmm. and look through his penny candy case on the corner of Packard and Church Street. And that building is still there.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Mr. Draper from that time. But there were just lots and lots of them. And we can mm-hmm. maybe get into that a little later when we mm-hmm. talked about when I was in the Bread Business Indicator, which was the first worked for Tasty Bread for 10 years before I went into photography.
Right. But now are you ready to finish high school?
I forgot. I knew we forgot something. Yes, I went to high school. Let's see, we had Mr. Kittner and I both went downtown to Decatur High School. He moved on to Decatur High School and became coach down there, and I went
down.
This
was in the place where the Civic Center
now
is.
Yes, that was the old Decatur High School.
One's high school.
Yes, yes. And that was the only high school in mm-hmm. town. There were various junior high schools. I remember when I was at Roosevelt, we had arch enemy was Central High School, which mm-hmm. was out, there was an old building on the corner of Broadway and North Street, and then it became Johns Hill Junior High School.
Mm-hmm.
There was quite a rivalry between the junior high schools.
But only one senior high school.
Only one senior uh-huh. high school, yes, ma'am. And I can remember, I'm trying to think of some names. Can't think of the principal's name right offhand.
It wasn't Mr. Piggott.
No, Mr. Piggott was there during my stay. I got to know Mr. Piggott while I was there. Asa Sprunger was the assistant principal, mm-hmm. And I cannot think of the principal's name at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But we had things like Ruth Conard, who still lives out in the country, mm-hmm. out near my parents' house on the south side. She was my English teacher, mm-hmm. and names like this that I can mm-hmm. think of that some of the people are still around.
Mm-hmm.
Had very interesting woodworking classes mm-hmm. at that time, cabinet making mm-hmm. or woodworking. We made, now that this is the weekend of the boat races, we made a lot of pretty high-speed boats, racing boats in a boat class mix. With Mr. Schaefer, and I want to call him Gary Schaefer, and I think that was his brother, Russell Schaefer. Russell Schaefer was the teacher of the boat building class.
Mm-hmm. And the boats really worked.
Oh, they're beautiful boats.
The students built them?
Students built them
under supervision.
And sold them under supervision with Russell Schaefer. The money was sold, the profits went to the Board of Education, something like our house building projects that we have now. And when they quit the program, I remember we had six beautiful hulls left that were mahogany hulls, all plugged, and they were sold to the Chris Craft Company in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And they were later sold as Chris Craft boats, but they were built in Decatur High School boat building class.
Great.
But that ended that project because of somebody complaining about conflict of interest or commercialism in the schools.
It probably gave the students a great deal of excellent experience
and
practice.
Yes, very much so. But other than high school, then I think I graduated in the last mid-year class that they had, and I had Vera Hickey as an advisor. Vera Hickey, who later went on to marry Cocky Rotz. She has since passed away, and of course, as Mr. Rotz has. But I remember that I was to graduate in the class of 1932, but I spent quite a little time working at the YMCA on part-time. That's didn't do any sports or anything at that time, because after school I went down to the Y and worked with kids doing swimming and camping in the summertime and things like this. And I did a lot of work with the Gunhill Johnson Cripple Children's Room, it was called at that time. And that's when polio was called infantile paralysis.
And it was very prevalent then.
Yes, at the E.A. Gassman School there at the corner of North and Church Street. And I had a swim class with these kids once a week.
Was this kind of therapy for
As a therapy thing, and also to teach those that were teachable or capable to swim, to do a swim class thing. And then once a week I would go over at 1 o'clock and carry these huge DeVry portable 35-millimeter movie things over to show them. And I always missed my grammar class. And Cleta Moses is my grammar teacher, and I got an F in grammar, so consequently had to go back to high school one semester. I carried one course. No, I finally passed it. But when graduation time came, I was a credit and a half short to graduate with my class in 32.
Oh, too bad.
So I went back and took one course in algebra under Dale Snell. And his brother Robert Snell and Miss Palmer, who was a teacher at Roosevelt. I saw them yesterday. They're still around town.
Great.
Good to see old teachers and friends like them.
Your comment about the heavy movie equipment reminds me of a comment I heard that that time they put handles on equipment and called it portable. Anything. It was very heavy equipment.
We always said it was portable if the guy was big enough.
Well, now you're out of high school.
Yes, we're out of high school. That was the end of my formal training. I did as far as I didn't go to college.
Well, you know why? Probably think of the year you graduated.
Well, in 1933, this very good friend of mine who was I worked with at the YMCA in the boys' department went on to George Williams College, which was the YMCA college in Chicago. And he wanted in the worst way that I should go to college, and there was just no way. The money wasn't there. We couldn't afford it. There were no scholarships
and
things like that.
Well, what was your first job then? Oh, did you get a job?
Oh, yes.
That's a question.
Yeah.
Many people didn't.
Never been out of work, and I'm always amazed at kids today who quit and don't have another job and take off. In my time, you didn't leave one job until you had another one to go to, because payday every Friday or Saturday was very important.
Well, what was your first job?
My first job, I went to work for the Tasty Bread Company. I worked part-time at the at the YMCA and boys department as an assistant boys secretary, finally.
Did you deliver the bread, or did you make it?
No. I was we called them bread salesmen. You used to make everybody mad if they called you a truck driver, because you were a salesman, and that was what they drummed into you down at the place. First manager was a fellow named Don Wimmer, and he was the one who was a great, as far as I'm concerned, a great salesman, character builder of sorts. Said, if you can do this job and do it well, you could do anything. So I've kind of believed him.
Well, good.
And I worked there for 10 years and wound up being the assistant sales manager, but got interested in photography as a hobby all during that time, and left and went to work after 10 years for the good old File Photo Shop down on the corner of Prairie and Main Street. Worked there for 6 years and left and went to the newspaper.
Well, in photography, what are the changes you've noticed in that field?
Miniaturization. If you'll excuse the term, I swear my right arm is longer than my left one by carrying this huge suitcase that housed an 8x10 Eastman Kodak all-metal view camera, which we did in a lot of commercial. That was in commercial work. And we did a lot of things, all hours of day and night, window displays, all kinds of group shots and things like this. And you carried a huge camera and this tripod that could be that was made out of 2-inch aluminum tubing with huge wing nuts and could be extended to about 9 feet. And you carried two huge number 4 photo photo flood bulbs,
yeah,
in large reflectors and light stands with probably 2 50-foot extension cords, mm-hmm, where you would go in. So today it's much different. Everybody carries on a 35 millimeter camera with a little flash on the top, mm-hmm, or if you're getting real fancy, you use a slave unit off to one side.
Well, then you, let's talk about your first photographic job. Before you went to, you had a job, you said, before you went to the newspaper.
Yes, that was at Files Camera.
At Files Camera.
Did a lot of, mm-hmm, things, traveled the state over. My biggest one account, mm-hmm, I suppose, would have been Standard Oil Company, which did a lot of work in the coal mines with them on their, as doing illustrations for their lubricating stuff. Did a lot of catalog.
You went down
things
in the mines,
oh,
to,
yes,
photograph?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
Well, that was a real experience.
That's a whole story by itself, and it would take us a whole new, mm-hmm, tape to talk about my coal mining things with them. But we did a lot of weddings. At that time, the candid wedding thing was coming, mm-hmm, in, and we used a 4x5 speed graphic to do, mm-hmm, those. Today they do it with either a Rolleiflex or a 35 millimeter. Mm-hmm. That's 120 being the Rolleiflex. Did a lot of weddings. Can name half of your people in town that I've done their wedding pictures, and I can call off people like Record and Lant Holt and Osgoods, and all up and online. Did a lot of those things during, mm-hmm, that 6-year period, mm-hmm, I was there.
Did you do any other industrial photography besides coal mines?
Yes, ma'am. You did everything. You did
all
everything.
All the orders that came in.
Practically built the ADM plant out there when they were doing that. We started from the time it was a hole in the ground to... we all the steel work up, and you did the progression things. Uh-huh. You'd shoot it from the time it started until the, uh-huh, time it was finished.
Did you process the pictures, thing yourself, a dark room?
Sure. You were your own lab technician. Mm-hmm. Finally, after it got going a while, we finally got an assistant in the lab to help. We worked business up to where it was too much for one person, mm-hmm, so I had an inside man. Mm-hmm. And then a little later on, we hired Bill Summer, who now runs Summer Studio, mm-hmm, in Decatur. Bill was probably instrumental in me being in photography. It was a hobby with him, and we all belonged to the old Decatur Camera, uh-huh, Club. And, uh-huh, so Bill was working in the biscuit business, worked for Nabisco. Right. Called him up one day and said, how'd you like to go to work in a photo business?
Yeah.
And he was tickled death and quit and came to work and was my assistant for until the time I left, uh-huh, and went to the newspaper. And during that time, we did a lot of things for the paper. That's
how we got started.
Yes,
paper,
ma'am.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're
a lot of society things, yeah, we called them in those days. Now it's lifestyle or something.
Right. Are we ready to talk about your work at the newspaper?
Oh, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Maybe you could tell us something about changes at the paper, or have there been any? Have you noticed?
The changes have been major. Mm-hmm. Oh, major changes. Yes, ma'am.
In what way?
Photographically, in the equipment we used, mm-hmm, to all use speed graphics. And
one thing, as a reader, I've noticed is a tremendous improvement in newspaper pictures. Years ago, you could hardly see a newspaper picture. They were always so vague and dull and dim.
Well, this comes down to two things. Camera techniques and also reproduction processes, mm-hmm, are now much better, mm-hmm, to the point where we even do color and things, mm-hmm, now that we wouldn't dream of before. Mm-hmm. But I think possibly the biggest changes that we had now is content. We try to make a picture story tell, mm-hmm, a story rather, mm-hmm, than being a bunch of people lined up and going bang with a flashbulb, mm-hmm, stuck on the camera. Mm-hmm. And the whole concept of the miniature camera is that it's flexible. We can use the room light. It looks like the way you saw it when you were there, mm-hmm, in other words. That part along with that. Newspaper has changed to the effect that we probably are better organized. Our news is packaged much better. There are some people that may question this over the last, mm-hmm, couple of years since we've had a change of ownership. But our treatment of news, like everything else, journalism has, mm-hmm, advanced along with everything else, and the techniques have all changed. And how to present the news so it's interesting for people to read. Picking your priorities about what are the best things to run, mm-hmm, who's going to read the most, and so on.
Do you remember any of the most interesting assignments you had on the paper?
Oh, there were just many of them. I think the most interesting ones, the more interesting ones, were probably riding on the presidential trains. Everybody that was a presidential candidate did a whistle stop thing through
Illinois.
Tell
us about them.
And we would go over to maybe Effingham and get on the train and ride with Goldwater. We'd go over to Mattoon. We went to Danville and got on with Nixon, rode with Nixon twice. We went to Springfield and I got on the train and rode with Adlai Stevenson. Both times he ran for president and was defeated both times. And the idea being that you would go along with him, and then at each of these little towns, the local politicians would get on, and you'd make photographs of the local politicians with the presidential candidate. And I covered JFK. I covered him lots of times. One of the ones I can remember most was, I had a prize-winning series on sequence pictures when he was as a senator, and this was in 1961 at the Armory in Springfield, where we did a sequence on him, and that was the year he became president.
You mean he was campaigning?
That was in his campaign tour, yes. Mm-hmm. And there's numerous stories about those little incidents on the Kennedy campaign with Pierre Salinger. Okay. A couple of things when he said, I couldn't stand there, and I had enough equipment hanging around my neck that looked like a traveling camera store and a tripod and a long setup with some long lenses to do this thing. And he come along and says, you can't stand here. This is for the national press. And I called him over and whispered in his ear and I said, Mr. Salinger, I'm a senior in high school here in Springfield. And if I don't get a picture of Mr. Kennedy, I get an F in journalism. And he immediately shouts, get out of here. But we got to stay where we were implanted and did this. AP was the first prize winner in AP that year in their photo contest. Uh-huh. Many funny things happened. Was with Kennedy today, the Cuban crisis came up. He was at the Coliseum in Springfield. And he immediately took off for Washington with the under the pretext that he had a cold.
Mean the Bay of Pigs.
No. Well, yes, yes.
Well,
yes.
You mean he wasn't in Washington?
That's then? When he was president then.
Oh, yes.
I'm maybe a little ahead of myself.
Yeah, right.
I'm doing first his thing as a candidate.
I understand.
And then he's the president.
I'm surprised that he left Washington when that was coming up.
That was when they started the Cuban blockade.
Oh, yeah. All the Cuban blockade.
Yeah, which was following the Bay of Pigs and the Russian missile.
Yeah.
Russian missile crisis.
Right.
That's hard to say.
Right, it is.
That was the Russian missile crisis, not the Bay of Pigs. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Got that one a little.
Uh-huh.
But, traveled with Lyndon Johnson, and I have a collection of buttons and banners and press credentials at home that I managed to somehow or other stick on the wall at one time or another, and over the years it gets to be quite impressive when you look at all the numbers, shall we say. Did Senator Muskie when he was campaigning for vice president and a few other things.
I suppose you covered disasters?
All kinds of things. Yes, many disasters. Fires, bad wrecks, things of this kind that have been
not
bad.
I suppose interesting from a photographic point of view, but not as much fun as some of the other things.
Spectacular. I remember one of the more spectacular fires was the old wooden shoe, which was down on the corner of South State Street and East Main, right behind the President Milliken Bank Building, which at that time was called the Standard Office Building.
Mm-hmm.
And it burnt one night and made some rather spectacular fire pictures. Fire pictures were always spectacular if it was a good fire.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody said, what is a good fire? I said, well, if it's a good fire, it'll be going when you get there, and if it isn't, they'll have it put out before you get there.
Can you think of any other special assignments that you remember?
Oh, there are many special ones. Did Bob Hope?
Did
some things with Bob Hope. One of the state fair trips he was over, got to do the press conference thing and some things with him. One of the more memorable ones that was the most fun that I got to spend a day with was Victor Borge.
Oh.
And he came to town.
Is he as much fun off stage?
He is much fun off stage as he is on stage. And we got him off. He came into Decatur and trained. And the first thing I said, he had a motorcycle patrol, and I said, how about getting you on a motorcycle leading the patrol? And he went over and hopped on the motorcycle, sitting there with the officer's cap on and clowning it up and hamming it up. Took him down to the old Hotel Orlando. And at that time, he was in a poultry business, raising little Cornish hens that he had out in Connecticut. And I said, you're a cook. Can we get something like this? And he said, yeah, find me a chef's hat and one of those big chopping knives. So we run downstairs to the kitchen, get one of the huge chef hat, one of these huge chopping knives. And in the room was a bowl of fruit. So here he stands with his chef's hat and his thing and socks and apple on the top of this knife and stand here and mugs it up for the camera.
Great.
Went down on the street with him and talked to people on the street. And then that night at the audience, at the performance, John Rammel, who was a former photographer of ours, who is now on the picture desk at the Milwaukee Journal, John and I were there running around, and he came over, and the place was packed in the old Kittner gym at Stephen Decatur High School. It was called Decatur High School at that time. And he came over, struck a match, and walked around and said, "Oh, there you are down there. If you'd have bought a ticket, you wouldn't have to sit on the floor. You could sit in the seats like everybody else." And so Victor Borga has been a friend of mine, I mean a favorite of mine for a long time.
He's a natural comedian.
Just a natural. Just a wonderful person. And a clown all the way through, you know. And very intelligent man.
Okay.
Those are some of the funny things you can think of. Gee, we do all kinds of unhappy things. Funerals and tragedies and things we've gone through where you feel like you don't belong there, but you need to be there because people want to know what goes on, and we should relay the message.
Do you have any, I wonder, is there any technique for getting into, you told us about one that you tried with Pierre Salinger. I was wondering, it takes a lot of nerve to do some of these assignments, doesn't it?
I would, not nerve so much. You try to stay in the background. You try not to be stuck out like a sore thumb. I mean, you try to be as unobtrusive as you can. You try to be polite to people.
They expect you to be there.
They expect you to be there. You generally have, in some cases, even a roped-off area that they put you in, which restricts your move.
Do they welcome you?
Pretty much welcome you, and especially in the political things, because they're looking for the exposure. And I'm thinking of the pictures I did of Governor Ogilvy and Richard Nixon and his daughter when they got off the airplane at Springfield on a visit there. We were out in the middle of a little roped-off area, and some lady and little son was standing in front of us, and the photographers are there. How she got into the press area, I don't know. But she kept telling this little kid, "Don't let these guys push you around," and we were all kind of laughing about, well, what's she doing here in the first place? There's all kinds of funny things about press credentials, and it gets stricter now. We carry a pass from the Secret Service, which is an identifying thing. If you're working on an important person, you wear that on a chain around your neck so that the Secret Service knows who you are and what you're doing there.
Did they investigate you?
Oh, yes, ma'am. Very, very closely. Mm-hmm. And every time there was I don't know when Johnson was in, or any of the presidential candidates or presidents, period, you sent over vital statistics like your Social Security, where you're born, and a little resume and so on. And those were all checked out before your credentials were ever issued, which was generally a badge that you got a war on that lets you pass the, to wear on your coat or around your neck or fastened to your belt to get you past the Secret Service people.
Right. Well, it sounds as if you're very happy with your work.
Yes, I'm very fond of it. I don't know anything that I like better. I really enjoy newspaper work. We do everything from, we used to joke about it with John Rammel. I said, "Your work must really be exciting." And he said, "Yes, it's like Casey the crime photographer, but I haven't solved a crime all day, and I got to get back to the darkroom and process his darn film." So one of the other things that that we do and do well at our newspaper, and probably do more of than most newspapers, is aerial photography. And of course, that's kind of my forte. That's the thing I like to do best. Mm-hmm. I suppose the things that I really enjoy, because I love to fly and like to fly in these little grasshopper.
Do you fly your own plane?
No, I know how to fly.
But can't fly.
I have a student's license that went way back when. Mm-hmm. Yes, I do get to fly the airplane. Generally tell the pilot, "You hold on while I get to shoot this," you know. But I like to fly in these small airplanes, and would put you down within a 1,000-foot level, or sometimes right across the rooftop, so to speak. But we probably covered about everything in central Illinois from the major interchanges, and I'm thinking some of the things like at Effingham, which we came across the other day. It looked like a major piece of art in the snow when they were merely grading up for this thing, and gee whiz, that darn thing's been in several years now. But we've done train wreck. We've been very fortunate. About every time there was a train wreck, I think I've covered about every major train wreck in the area over the years. We used to laugh at a fellow named Pappy Lewis, who said, "Don't you ever fly when the sun is out and it's nice and bright, because it would obviously be on a day It was stormy, raining like heck, and we'd fly to Mattoon, ride down on the deck to get in underneath to shoot the pictures we needed on that. It pretty much documented the city on everything from real estate developments to industry to our most recent trip had to do with the new changes at 22nd and Staley Overpass, the Viaduct. The shopping centers, I think I've literally developed every shopping center from the time they started scraping it off until they practically had the ribbon cutting with aerial pictures. We've done that. And our newspaper has done a real good job on aerial photography, and we're kind of noted for it as far as recognition on aerials. We probably print more aerial, more space devoted to aerial photography than I think anybody in the state.
Mr. Strongman, have you you worked at the on the newspaper, I believe, a long time. Have you ever thought about retiring?
Oh, yes, ma'am. I didn't tell you that. Betty, when we were out with Bob Sampson the other day, we had thought about it. But May the 1st, I'd been at the paper 30 years. And then come July, I'm a couple of years over that, what most people call retirement time. So I'm going to retire as of June the 19th. That'd be my last working day. I do have 4 weeks vacation coming, so officially I think I'm probably tied in until about July the 15th or somewhere along in there. But I don't expect to hang all this machinery up, these nice pieces of equipment that we have. I think we'll probably work on a freelance contract type thing, and the paper seems to think they may be able to keep me busy on some things, but don't have any plans for that period. We just cut it off clean and said, well, I'll be a freelancer as of June the 19th.
You're in a very enviable position because you're not working. You're in a way you can make your it still make your hobby your work at part time anytime you want to.
Yes,
and yet you'll have free time.
I think, as one of my bosses says, Dick Brodigan, my managing editor, said, who he and I have had most of the discussions and I've worked with for years, said, well, the difference between now and then is that I can call you up now and tell you I need an assignment and you can't say no, but I can call you up then and you can say, gee, I'm sorry, boss, I just don't want to do this one today.
And that's a wonderful feeling.
And, I don't know how this will all work out. It's a new experience, a rather traumatic affair for me. When you've done something 30 years and it's a 24-hour day, 7-day a week thing when you try to keep track of all the news.
But I recommend retirement. I think you will enjoy it.
I don't know. We'll see if my wife can put up with me being around the house or underfoot that long.
Well, if she gets tired of you, she can just ask you to take a job
someplace. Or rock out and mow the yard.
Yes, right. Well, I certainly have enjoyed hearing your experiences, and we thank you for sharing your life with us. Did you have something to
say? Nothing more. Now, there are many, many things, and gee, you can't condense 30 years.
Mr. Strongman, I can't let you go without hearing about the Truman story that you were telling me. Let's put it on tape.
Well, we'll try and make it quick so you don't run out the end of your cassette there. Harry Truman was going back to Washington after he had been president. He'd gone back to Independence, Missouri, and was on the way back into Washington and was driving through. And he stopped at the old Parkview Motel, which was our first really major motel in Decatur. At that time, it was considered kind of fancy. He stopped there, and for some reason or other, the rest of our people couldn't get to him. And we had been with him when he was on his tour through Decatur, knew about the time they put in their back to his train into the crowd and things like that. So I said, well, gee, I'll bet I can get next to him. So we go out, and I knew the fellow who ran the motel, and I asked him if I could please speak with Mr. Truman. And I said, I'm familiar with him, and he might remember. And sure enough, he called him, and Harry stepped outside the door and said, sure, I remember the crowd at Decatur and how we almost backed the train into him because we had a picture of him holding his hands up, waving the crowd back.
Well, maybe you should explain how that happened. How did it happen?
The engineer had a mark on the rail. He was supposed to stop the engine at this particular chalked-off mark that the Secret Service had put, which would put the old observation car at Morgan Street at the Wabash Depot so that it would be where the crowd would be. And there were literally thousands of people that gathered around the back of it. And the engineer pulled 4 feet past the chalk mark, so he said, gosh, I got to get it backed up. And so meantime, the crowd had surged forward, and the engineer started to ease this train back in the crowd, and Harriet, Bess, and Margaret Truman are all standing on the back of the train trying to wave everybody to get out of the way. For some reason or other, we're backing up and don't know why. So he remembered the incident.
And you got a picture of Mr. Truman directing the traffic.
Yes, hold everybody, get back, you know. And that's when John Rammel and I were covering that particular assignment. Anyhow, he remembered that, and so I told him I'd like to have a picture of him coming through Decatur, and he asked if we were going to press yet that evening, and I said, no, it doesn't come out until tomorrow morning. And he agreed that he could do it because he didn't want a lot of people coming out. He didn't want to come through town and have everybody in town coming out with an announcement in the paper or a picture in the paper. So he came out the door, and we talked a little bit, and he wanted to know what kind of picture I wanted to make. And I said, say, what do you think if we had you stretched out on the couch in your room and we had Bess fanning you like a prize fighter does with a copy of the Herald and Review? That'd be a heck of a picture. You know? They promote the newspaper's name and get the Decatur Herald on there. And he went in, and he came out, and Bess says, hell no. So we got him putting his luggage in the back of this big black Chrysler, and that was the first time I ever got anything in Time magazine. My picture, okay. Harry Truman loading up his luggage into his Chrysler, headed back to Washington after the presidency. But he was a wonderful man to be around. Very humorous, and as I said, talked a little rough at times, and didn't make any bones about it.
Well, that was a real coup, and getting it in time, too. That was feather in your cap.
Well, as I said, the more we talk, as you know, the more we talk, right. One of these brings on another, and this could go on for days.
Well, maybe we will sometime. Thank you very much, Bob, for your stories of your experiences during your years in Decatur. We've certainly enjoyed your anecdotes. You've been listening to the reminiscences of Mr. Bob Strongman. This is Betty Trunell for the Decatur Public Library.